Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. I'm Liz, joining you as usual from Central Virginia in the United States on the ancestral lands of the Monacan people, which right now are absolutely ablaze in the most beautiful fall colors I've seen in a long time. So I'm so glad you're here with me. And if you happen to be listening to this on release day, then I'm also sending you Taurus full moon blessings. And I hope wherever you are in the world, if the weather is cooperating, that you're able to get outside and bask in her glory. So sometimes I have guests on the show whose backstories and bios just kind of take my breath away. And today is one of those days. I'm going to share a little bit of her background with you, and then obviously we'll get into that much more. So you'll hear these details yourself, but for now, it's enough to say that when I think of sacred activism and how we can use our spiritual practice to guide us into right action in the world, I really cannot think of a better role model for us to hear from. Reverend Mary Moreno Richardson is a retired Episcopal priest and the creator director of the Guadalupe Art Program, a spiritual empowerment program using the arts to heal violence against women and children. Focused on the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the most ubiquitous icon in Latino culture, participants explore, develop, heal, and deepen their spiritual lives through the arts. Far exceeding her role as a chaplain, Mary is a champion for victims of human trafficking, undocumented youth in detention who are awaiting deportation hearings, and women and children who are victims of violence. Mary has served as a delegate to the United Nations and as a member of the Committee of the Status of Women. She is the first Latina priest ordained in the Diocese of San Diego, California, and she's a strong advocate against war on drugs policies, instead advocating for treatment over incarceration. Mary and her work have been featured on PBS and in Latina magazine, El Latino, La Frontera, and she was the cover story of Episcopal Life. And just this year, she is also the recipient of the Woman of the Year Achievement Award from the Commission for Women of Santa Barbara County. Mary is joining us today from her home in Santa Barbara, California. And Mary, welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm so glad to have you here.
Good morning, Liz. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you so much. I've so been looking forward to this conversation. And I also have to say that, you know, just for listeners, as I was going through your bio, there's a lot more that I didn't even add in. So your background is so impressive. I can't wait to talk through some of this with you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to start with you. You know, I usually start most of these conversations just trying to get a little bit of a sense of people's spiritual background. So I wonder if you could tell us, you know, what spiritual experiences you were exposed to growing up.
Sure. You know, I grew up Roman Catholic, and I came from a home that was very devout Roman Catholic. My father was like, you know, the Grand Knight of the Knights of Columbus. My mother was the president of the Ladies Guild, and I attended Catholic school most of my life. And this was in the late 50s and early 60s. And so, unfortunately, it wasn't the best experience. I'm one of those recovering Catholics.
And, we've had some of those here before.
You know, and this is my story. And, you know, I not to say negative things about the church in any way, but this is my story and what I experienced and part of my spiritual path. And so for me, you know, I remember going to Catholic school, my parents being so Catholic, believing that nuns and priests walked on water. And my experience was so full of fear. And there was so much abuse in the system and in the school itself, and a lot of religious abuse of using God to scare you. And I remember thinking, you know, how we make the sign of the cross in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And I thought, my goodness, it's more like in the name of shame, guilt, and fear, because I felt that's what I was always feeling. And the way God was used is this punishing God who was just writing down all your sins and, you know, couldn't run away from that. So I think for me, that was very difficult. I remember also, you know, coming of age, I think I was probably in the sixth grade, and I went to school, and it was the first day I went to school and I was wearing a bra, and it was definitely time for me to wear a bra. I think my father had mentioned to my mother, like, it's time for that girl to get a bra. And I remember going to school, and, you know, we had our little white Peter Pan blouses that we used to wear. And the nun called me over, and I guess she could see that I was wearing a bra underneath my little blouse. And she called me over and she poked me in the chest and she said, "You make boys sin."
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, as a child, you just kind of internalize that and you feel guilt and shame and all of that. But I also remember after a while thinking about it, thinking, wow, I finally have some power, because I just felt that I had no power, that my power had been taken away, that I never even had it. So those experiences were very important to me growing up. And it helped me. At first, I just accepted it. I accepted that girls were less than boys, that our power was taken away from us. And I just kind of lived in that. And, you know, it wasn't until later on that in my spiritual experience that began to change for me.
Wow. I'm surprised, I guess. And I'd love to hear you talk about this, but I'm surprised given your experience that you didn't abandon Christianity altogether. It sounds like, well, I don't know. I mean, so I assume you took a step back from Catholicism, right? Because you made your way to the Episcopalian Church, but you didn't abandon Christianity altogether.
No, I didn't, because I was able to separate in my mind my faith and from, you know, the institution. And I think that was had to do a lot with the way I was raised. In the Catholic tradition and in the Latino tradition, Mary is so important. And so in my room, I always had a shrine to the Blessed Mother, and we always prayed the rosary. And I can always remember as a little girl, my mother would say, every time we left the house, she would say to me, "Remember who you are." And I knew what that meant. She meant, you are the daughter of the Blessed Mother. Make me proud. And I remember that as a child, remember who you are. And I would walk out of the house thinking, yes, I know who I am, you know? And of course, when I became a teenager and started dating, and she would say that before I left on a date, she'd say, remember who you are. And I thought, oh, okay. But, you know, that was always the focus in our family. It seemed so much more spiritual for me. And so I remember my mother started the novena to our Mother Perpetual Help in our church. And we would go every Tuesday night to novena for years. And, you know, it was the beautiful songs that we sang to Mary. And then on May, the month of May was the month of Mary. And we would take white roses to her shrine. And that was always such a beautiful thing to me. And it was very touching and deep. And I always remember also the sacramental part of that, of, you know, making my first communion. And I remember hearing, you know, that Christ would come into your heart and nobody could take that away. The peace that would come into my heart would not be taken away. And because there was so much abuse in the classroom and negativity and all of that, somehow that brought me peace. And that was so important to me. And I can remember, I had an uncle who was a Roman Catholic priest, and he would come and he would go to the convent and say mass for the nuns. And then I would go, and I was probably in the fourth grade. And I remember watching him and thinking, oh my God, that's what I want to do. You know, I want to do that the sacramental ritual of the body and blood of Christ. That was just so touching to me. And I remember sharing with one of the nuns at recess. I went up and I said, you know, sister, I know what I want to be when I grow up. And she said, well, what is that? And I said, I want to be a priest just like my uncle. And she said to me, you stupid little girl, that will never happen. And I thought, oh, okay. It's like you just kind of, okay, whatever they said, you just bought into it. What else could you do? And so, you know, I went along on my spiritual journey. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'll have 35 years sobriety in January. Wow. But a lot of that came for me in once I left the church, probably in my I'd say middle 20s. I had just had enough, you know, with the whole birth control. And I was able at that time to really say, okay, I'm not buying this anymore. And I walked away from that. And I was very much into the 12-step programs, which really helped me understand about a loving God, which I really needed in my life. And, you know, and it was about a God of my own understanding. It was a power greater than myself. And that just helped me so much because I felt that the God that I was raised with, I was so afraid of. I just felt that it was this God that was writing down my sins day and night. And in the 12-step program, you know, once again, I learned about this wonderful loving God. And so that really helped me. And then I probably had about 10 years sobriety or so. And I came across someone who had asked me, they said, oh, do you still go to church? And I said, oh, no. And they said, well, you know, you might like the Episcopal Church. It's kind of like Catholic light. And I thought, really? And, you know, I missed the sacramental part. I really did. And so I went and I visited the Episcopal Church and I really liked what it was about. It was friendly and welcoming. And it was more about the resurrection and less about the crucifixion, if that makes sense. I felt that in the Catholic tradition, they use the crucifixion in a way to make us feel guilty or to scare us or to say, look what you've done to the Lord, you know, that type of mentality. And I felt that in the Episcopal Church, it was once again, so much more about the resurrection. And so that became important to me. And I remember sharing with one of the priests that I wanted to be a priest when I grew up. And he said, well, why don't you? And I thought, oh my God, I never ever even thought that was an option. And so I started the process of ordination, which I was able, you know, the long process of, you know, going to seminary and everything. And it was an experience. One of the things I walked away with, I thought was interesting, was I was so excited about going to seminary. I thought it was going to be a wonderful spiritual experience, and it really wasn't. I remember our new, I think it was the New Testament class, and the professor had us memorize a map of all the different places in the Middle East. And, you know, all the students were saying, but why do we have to do this? This just seems, what are we going to use this for? And he says, well, I've always done it with my students and we're going to do it. And it just set like such bad energy in the class for the rest of the year. It was just kind of, it just didn't feel as spiritual as I was expecting it to. So that was something that I thought was, you know, interesting and just so part of the institution, I believe.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I it's interesting that you say that because I was just thinking as you're talking, you know, it seems like, and you're describing both in your experiences as a child and as an adult, there's this, and you tell me if this sounds right to you, but there's on the one hand, there's the classroom experience that in no way seems to connect with your faith and spiritual experience. Does that feel accurate? And if so, I wonder what you make of that.
Yes, it was exactly what you're saying. And it was kind of like you would feel so confused because, you know, you had this love for God and, you know, the saints and the Mary. I mean, they were so important to me in my life. And then there was this institution. And, you know, I feel bad for the nuns. I mean, I always feel like we're victims of victims of victims. And I'm sure that they were only teaching us what they were taught. Unfortunately, it wasn't empowering and it wasn't supportive. And so I have that compassion for nuns that so many of them, you know, took that path. And yet, so many children suffered from it. So it's interesting for me to see that the difference in the faith and institution. I know when I'd be preaching, I would always tell people in my congregation, because I had so many people who came who were also Roman Catholic, and now we're looking for something, mostly women who were divorced with children who could no longer receive the sacrament in the Roman Catholic Church. Mm. And in our tradition, it's whoever you are and wherever you find yourself in the journey of faith, everyone is welcome to the table. And, you know, I had mothers that hadn't received communion in 15 years that would come to the altar in tears of joy because now they were able to receive again. So that was a wonderful experience, and to help people heal that spiritual hurt.
Yes. Yes. Well, and I guess the another thing that you said, you were saying that the, you know, Catholicism, the focus was on the crucifixion, whereas, you know, in the Episcopal Church, it's on the resurrection. And I, you know, I grew up Baptist. And so that feels consistent for me in terms of like, Protestant faith.
Yes.
But what I don't know about the Episcopal Church is, you know, for me, it seems like to have that more positive focus on the resurrection, we traded, at least in the Baptist faith, any aspect of the divine feminine. No, there's absolutely no Mary whatsoever. She's just not present. And so I'm curious if in the Episcopal faith, if and how, you know, the Blessed Mother is present there.
Yes, she is. Not quite in the same way as in the Roman Catholic, but very open. One of the things I really enjoyed in my ministry was that because I worked with the Latino community, Mary was so important. And so, you know, I brought Guadalupe into the church, and we had all of the different celebrations and serenades on her feast day. And so the church was open to that. You know, they looked at it as accepting cultural background, which was wonderful, and people were able to come and celebrate her, and there was never a question of it. I think a lot of people who may have come from another tradition, maybe more of a Protestant tradition, would kind of say, well, isn't that a Catholic thing? And I would always say, well, you know, Mary's open to everything. Nobody owns Mary.
Oh, I love that. Well, and then it's Mary, you know, because one of the big questions I have for you, and I always ask every guest on here too, since this is a show about home to her, you know, that who is the sacred feminine to you? Does Mary embody that for you, and how do you experience her in your experience of faith?
I believe that, yes, Mary is very important to me as that, the divine feminine, but I also believe that we're all claiming our divine power and becoming more intuitive. And I think for me, it has to do, yes, with Mary and all of the different traditions and all of the different, the images that she holds. But also, I have a real closeness to the saints. And, you know, I'm so inspired by the saints, you know, Joan of Arc and Mary Magdalene and all of these incredible women that we read about, and, you know, and they're just have always inspired me. I find that their courage and their faith and their stories are something that I go back to all the time and think, oh my goodness, it's kind of like being able to read these stories and internalize them. And these are women who, you know, some of them are just amazed at what they've done. You know, their stories are so powerful. There's that one saint, her name is Thecla, I believe. I'm not sure how to pronounce this. It's T-H-E-C-L-A, Thecla. Okay. And she was the one that heard St. Paul preaching in the streets. And her mother was going to have her married to a pagan, right? And she said, no, I want to follow Christ. And so they arrested her and they, you know, had her burning at the stake for her faith. And she went proudly to the stake. And, you know, this amazing miracle happened where all of a sudden it started raining and it stopped the fire. And so she continued to follow Paul. But it was interesting because she told Paul after that event of being almost killed, that she wanted to be baptized. And St. Paul said, well, no, I don't think you're ready. Like, what? What do you mean she's not ready? And then, you know, the story goes on that she was in Syria and there was somebody in government in Syria who wanted to make her his bride. And she said, absolutely not. And she made a big scene. And so once again, they arrested her and they threw her to the wild beasts. And her image is always shown with a beautiful lioness that came and just sat by her and protected her in the arena. And then they threw her in this big water tank that was full of like wild sea lions. And she threw herself in there and she says, I baptize myself. And I just, that whole story reminds me of taking back our power. And I felt that as a child, I was never given any power. I felt that if I had any power, it was never supported. And when I read her story, I think, yes, you know, on a spiritual level, I can take back that power of who I really truly am. And that to me, once again, becomes about the feminine power, you know, that feminine divine that all of us have. And I think it's so important. The other day I was reading that there's a beautiful sculpture that was commissioned in Europe, and it celebrates all of the women who were burned at the stake for being witches, right? By King James.
Yes.
And, you know, all those were the wise women, the midwives. And because they had that power, of course, they were killed. And I think now we're living in a time where women like yourself, we're taking back our power. We're speaking, we're just ready to take it back and to share it with other women and with the world. And I think that's what we need as far as healing our world, you know, is that feminine power.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the saints. A couple of episodes before this, I have a woman on named Coco who's producing a movie about St. Teresa of Avila. Mm-hmm. And we had such an interesting conversation about, and I think you're speaking to it too, this idea, well, in her mind, St. Teresa absolutely qualifies as a witch, which was a wise mm-hmm. woman, you know, and she, she was actually converted Jew, and she figured out a way to not only survive, but be taken seriously at a time when women weren't, you know, and she found a path in the church. And so I find this really interesting and really challenging to hold at the same time, that on the one hand, you know, we can acknowledge just there's been a great deal of harm that's been done by the mm-hmm. church and by patriarchal mm-hmm. religions and just the way that women have been treated. I mean, mm-hmm. even the example that you gave of St. Paul saying, well, I don't think you're ready. Like, what? how can you not be ready after that? And there's this, you have these examples of these remarkable, powerful women who have things to teach us, and they found power inside systems and religions too that didn't believe they deserved it. And so I find that, like I said, I find it really inspiring and I find it really challenging at the same time to hold those things. And I wonder if you do too.
I do too, Liz. I do the same. It's empowering. And I just, you know, think that as women, we are creating our own spirituality/religion. It's kind of, I feel like I'm taking what I want and I'm leaving the rest. Mm. I'm taking the sacramental part, which no one can ever take away from me. And I'm leaving the rest, the institution, the part that I just don't resonate with anymore. And I know, you know, when you work inside the church, you see another side of the church that people don't see. And for me, that was difficult. So I'm so glad that I'm able to walk away from the institution, but be able to say, I know who I am. I know what I can share with people. And this is mine to give.
I love that. I do. Well, and I was going to ask you, you know, what your relationship is to the church today. How would you describe it?
Well, you know, I'm retired. Yeah. And the only time I really do anything that would be the, you know, part of the church is if someone asks me, you know, to perform you know, officiate their wedding or funeral, something like that, a baptism, I'm more than glad to. I once in a while will fill in for priests if they need to go on vacation. And I mostly for the Spanish speaking congregations, I really enjoy that. There's something so devout and so spiritual about being with that particular community. When I was at St. Paul's Cathedral in San Diego, I was the priest in charge for the Spanish congregation. And there was, I remember how beautiful it would be to see families coming up to communion. And after the communion, they would go over to the painting of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and the family would light a candle together and say a special prayer. And then they would go to their pews. And I just, that just touched me so much, so deeply that, and so it's just kind of, I always felt, I always said, you know, I always found God in the pews.
Oh, I love that. But how perfect. And of course, that's where God should be, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, to me, it's more, I'm kind of more focused on, you know, my work as a hypnotherapist, and I still work with, you know, victims of sexual assault and human trafficking. And, you know, once again, just like the saints, I love the idea of using archetypes for helping people understand and heal. When I used to go to juvenile hall, I would work with the kids there. And of course, this was in LA, which is the largest juvenile hall in the United States. And of course, it's full of children of color, Black and Latino. And I remember working with these children, and I would use different archetypes. And I remember telling the girls, because it was at a time where there were so many girls joining gangs. And it broke my heart. I thought, oh my God, it's as women, as you know, the feminine, why are you going on that road? It's so negative. It's that energy of fighting and violence and just, you know, a bad path to go. And I remember telling them the story of Snow White. You know, I would bring in these little Disneyland cards with all the princesses on them. And I'd say, okay, pick your favorite princess. And they would. And then I'd say, why? And they would tell their own stories, you know, behind that. And so we would talk about Snow White. And I said, you know, these are beautiful stories. I said, but, you know, Snow White is really the story about the eagle and the soul. And the evil queen represents the ego, and Snow White represents the soul. And when she takes the apple, it's like she's been drugged, right? And so she's asleep and she's no longer awake until, you know, the prince comes and wakes her up. And I said, I think we have the wrong understanding of the prince. I believe the prince to be the Christ that comes and wakes us up, you know? And I see these young girls that a lot of them were already addicted to drugs. And so I felt like they were asleep. They had taken that poison apple and had been asleep. And so it was like the whole idea of helping them wake up to their own spirituality and empowering them in a different way, instead of thinking that they were being empowered by being in a gang.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting too. And I like how you, the interpretation of that story, it's also just a good reminder that, because I'm really interested in myth and symbolism, and it's fascinating to me how symbols change over time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so for example, the apple, I'm fascinated by the apple because once upon a time it had all of this connection to divine feminine pre-Christian traditions. You know, it was the sacred fruit of Hera. It was, you know, that's the name Avalon, comes from apple land in ancient England, right? But then it became this fruit of temptation or poison. And then, you know, again, like we can take these stories, they're sort of ever evolving, which I find really interesting. And we, you know, so we can, like, they're not fixed, I guess, is what I'm saying. We can.
Yes. You know, they're wonderful metaphors for us to, you know, resonate with. And, you know, one of the things too, that I think is so important is that we move from that victim consciousness to non-victim. You know, so many of us may have been stuck in the idea of like, well, this is life. This is all I got. You know, I grew up in the ghetto and gang life is all I got, you know? And so it's almost like they put on the cloak of their own victimization instead of knowing that they have the power to step out of that and make different choices.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of how to, well, and I, so let's talk about your work. I do want to talk about that and the Guadalupe Art Program. And I want to come back to what you just said, but maybe even before we do that, could you, you know what, I would love for you to just explain, because you've used the word sacrament a couple of times, for people who are not, don't have a Catholic background or maybe even a Christian background, what you mean by that.
Well, in the Christian tradition, I mean, in the Episcopal and Roman Catholic, is we have the sacraments, which are baptism and the Eucharist, which is receiving the bread and body of Christ. And so that to me was always very important. And so the sacraments, again, are what we are given, you know, whether it's baptism or the Eucharist or trying to think what other marriage in the Roman Catholic Church was also a sacrament, ordination was a sacrament. And all of these were just outward signs of different, you know, blessings from God. But to me, I think the most sacred is the Eucharist, of that, of receiving the bread and wine made holy. Mm-hmm. Don't know if that kind of explains it a little bit.
It does. I actually like how you said it that way too, because you know, then it's applicable across many traditions too. You know, any food that we bless, right? Like that's, it changes. Yeah. It's like alchemy.
Right. Exactly. And I think that right now what we're coming to, what I see with all the different work that I do that is more spiritual and not religious, is exactly that alchemy, that, you know, I want to say magic, but some people are uncomfortable with that. You know, they're like, oh no, we shouldn't be doing that. And I'm thinking, why not? You know, this is what we are able to do. We can do all kinds of wonderful things. I do a lot of work with quantum physics, and I'm a student of quantum physics. And, you know, it says that everything is energy, and that we can do incredible things. And we're living, I think, you know, the norm of us as human beings right now is just at a level where we struggle. And if we could understand quantum physics and that everything is energy and everything is possible, we would be living incredible lives. I mean, I studied with a woman named Pam Osley, and she's here in Santa Barbara. She's an intuitive, and she's been on Dr. Oz, and she's been on The View and all of this. And she's just incredible. She's a medium, and she is my teacher when it comes to quantum physics. And she talks about, you know, like the five different levels of consciousness, and about, like, the example is about, you know, say you want ice cream. And so where we live right now as human beings is basically, to get that ice cream, you're going to have to get a job so that you can get a paycheck, so that you have the money to go to the store and buy that ice cream. And the second level is, and I think we all have experienced this in some way or another, is you think, boy, I really want that ice cream. And all of a sudden there's a knock on your door, and it's a friend, and says, you know, I was in the neighborhood and I brought you an ice cream. And it's that same energy of, like, when you think of a song and it comes on, or you think of someone and the phone rings and it's them, and we're connected to that energy field and we're picking up that energy. And then the third one is, we go to the refrigerator, we open it up, and there's the ice cream cone, right? And we know we didn't buy it. And then the fourth one is, we open our hands and there we go, I want an ice cream, and there it is. And the fifth one is you are the ice cream, right? That's like that very, very high level. And it's interesting because some people think, oh my God, what are you talking about? We could never do this. But yet Jesus said, you know, what I can do, you can do, and more. And I think we haven't been raised to understand the incredible power that we truly have. And we just stay at that limit of having to work so hard for what we have.
Yes. Well, and so this is something I would love to have your perspective on in the context of the work that you've done too, because I love these concepts. And when I hold them next to, like, let's say someone who's been the victim of human trafficking, though, like, how do we get from there? You know, like, that person certainly didn't ask for it, right? Like we know that for sure. Like that's just it's blatantly unfair.
And absolutely.
Yes. Or people who have what appears to have the deck stacked against them. You know, how does that relate to this concept? Because on the one hand, I'm like, okay, I'm sitting here in my comfortable house and I could probably, I could do this. I could really work on this, but I don't have a lot of adversity, honestly, you know, compared to many people. So I wonder, it feels like you have this really beautiful way to see into multiple worlds. And I wonder how that plays for you.
That's an interesting question. And I had the same feeling, you know, when I started working with survivors of human trafficking, I thought the same thing. It's like, why, how, why did this happen to this child, you know? Yeah. And as I start to see them healing in their own journey of healing, I don't know if it's maybe the more painful and difficult the hurt can be, that sometimes on the other side of it, you just heal and it becomes something so much more powerful on the other end. Do you know what I mean? It's like reclaiming your soul. I have one little girl that I worked with, and she was from Central America. And when she was coming up to Miami to be with her sister. And when she got to Tijuana, to the border, the traffickers separated her from the rest of the migrants. And they took her to a home or a house where they sold her for sex. And she was only like 15 years old. And so they sold her for sex there. And one day the traffickers said, you know, we're not going to be here today. They were going somewhere. And they said, don't even try to escape, because the house was surrounded by a gate, and inside that gate were like, I don't know, maybe 10 hungry dogs. And she says, if you try to escape, the dogs will attack you. And she thought, oh my God, what do I do? She said, if I stay, they're going to continue to abuse me, and if I leave, the dogs will attack me. And so she said, I'm just going to try to escape. And she got to the door and she turned the knob, and right away the dogs started growling. And she just said, oh God, just, you know, help me. And she opened the door, walked out, and the dog saw her, and they just laid down and let her walk out. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I said, honey, they recognized your innocence, you know. And she said, and she, you know, ran to the border where she was arrested, and she was put into a detention center for undocumented youth. And that's where I met her. And she was one of the participants in the Guadalupe art program, where she paints herself into the divine. And I remember, you know, when I told her she was going to do this project, she was just, you know, so heavy laden, so heartbroken, so, you know, the soul is just destroyed, you know, and as much as it can be. And she says, I can't do that. I don't know how to do that. And I said, no, you haven't learned how to do that. I said, you're going to learn how to paint. And so she did. And you could see as she would continue her painting that she was healing. And then finally she finished it and she turned around and she said, look, Reverend Mary, I found my soul again. And it was just this beautiful painting she did. It was just so wonderful, you know, just so moving. But I thought, that's so true. She found, you know, she reclaimed that power again. She reclaimed herself again. It wasn't taken away from her. It was still with her. And I think that healing power of art is so powerful.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. And even I want you to tell us a little bit more about the Guadalupe Art Program. But can you, for listeners who aren't familiar, we have talked about Guadalupe here on the show before. I think I'm pretty sure we have. Might have been my very first episode. But yes, can you tell us a little bit about like who Guadalupe is for people that may not know?
Absolutely. Our Lady Guadalupe is the image of Mary that appeared in Mexico. The story goes that she appeared in Mexico during the conquest. And the story of the conquest of Mexico is terribly bloody. a heartbreaking story. And even if you look at the cloak, you know, the image of Mary, it tells the story in her red cloak with all of the lines and everything that represents the streets that ran with blood because of all the indigenous people who were murdered during the conquest. And her cloak with all the stars tells the story of what the night looked like when she first appeared. And it's interesting because scientists have been able to go back now with the technology that we have to see her cloak and the way that the stars were. And they can go back to that same time in the 1500s of what the sky looked like. And so she came and appeared to Juan Diego, who was this indigenous man who, you know, was probably the poorest of the poor in a country where now he's basically a slave to the Spaniards. And Mary appears to him, and she talks to him in his own native Nahuatl language and asks him to go and tell the bishop to build a temple where she was. And where she appeared was on top of a temple that had been destroyed by the Spaniards, that was a temple to Tonantzin, who was the goddess. And so now Mary comes and says, I want a church built here in my honor. And so Juan Diego goes all the way to Mexico City, which is probably about maybe, I don't know, 15 miles, you know, a walk or maybe more or less, and tells the bishop that Mary wants this. And of course he's dismissed, completely dismissed. Who's mm-hmm. going to listen to a slave? I mean, basically that was the attitude. And so he goes back and tells Mary, they're not paying attention to me. There, and he goes, why don't you send someone, you know, who has some power, because they're not going to listen to me. And she says, no, I'm sending you. And it's interesting because, you know, we always hear in these stories how it's always, you know, the poorest of the poor, or that God chooses as their messengers. And so he goes back again, and once again he's rejected, and goes back and tells Mary, you know, no, they're not going to listen to me. And in fact, the bishop wants proof. And so she says, okay, go over to the side of the hill, and there's some Castilian roses that are growing there. And you know, Juan Diego said, Castilian roses? That doesn't happen here in December. And so he does. And there's this beautiful, beautiful, you know, beautiful roses just growing in all these colors. And he says, now pick them up and put them in your tilma, which was his cloak that he wore. And so he picked up all the roses, and he said, and she said, and bring them to me. And so he brings the cloak full of roses, and she arranges them and everything. And he says, now take this to the bishop and tell him that this is my proof. And so he goes all the way back and and meets with the bishop and opens the cloak. And there is the image of Mary, which to this day is the same image that is in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City, where they built the Basilica in her honor. And every year on December the 12th, you know, pilgrims come from all over. I think that's something like 6 million people show up. Yes. It's something, it's just so incredible. And the other part too that's interesting is that in Latin America, Mexico, you know, the mother, the image of the mother has always been so important. You know, the image of the divine mother has always been so important to the Latino community and the Mexican people. And she's always been there. She's always been a part of their lives. And you can see her if you go into any Latino neighborhood. She's everywhere. She's in grocery stores, and she's on walls, and she's on, you know, people's tattoos, and then everywhere. You know, I always say she was even at the Fillmore in San Francisco when Los Lobos played, and she was even in the movie, what was that, Harold and Maude in the Garden, you know. So we see her everywhere, and I think that that's just, you know, it's the mother taking care of those who suffer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think seeing Guadalupe, I went to Santa Fe right before the pandemic started, and also went down to Chimaya, which is, I don't know, about an hour and a half from Santa Fe, and it's a little chapel. It's just amazing. It's an amazing place. for many reasons, but among them are, there are so many different statues of Guadalupe and Mary, actually different representations of Mary from around the world. And the number of rosaries left to her is just staggering. And, you know, I was there on a given day. I think they just take them down and they get left again over and over and over again. And so for me, it was what I needed to see, you know, especially with my background. And there's a story that can be told about the divine feminine from a white European perspective that tells you that she was destroyed, taken away, or completely buried. And all you have to do is look at Guadalupe and the devotion to her to know that is not true. It is not true. Like it is, it is one part of our global story of the divine feminine. It is not the whole story. And so I was so, so moved by that. Just seeing how very present she was and how alive she was.
Isn't that true? And I think that she becomes more and more present every year. I just see her popularity growing, you know, not only with Latinos, but also with other people. We used to celebrate her feast day in San Diego, and we would have the serenade. And it was, but we had, I would organize it, and I organized it to be a bilingual service. And we would have people, even artists from LA, come and sing. And they would sing in English or they'd sing in Spanish. And it was just something so beautiful. We had dancers, we had Aztec dancers, flamenco dancers, ballet folklorico dancers. We had, people who sang in the choir. And it was just lovely, just an absolutely lovely experience. And it would grow. We would have so many people that would show up and just fill the church with roses and singing and, you know, just singing love songs to her. It was so beautiful.
Oh, I love that. What is that Guadalupe's feast day?
It's December the 12th.
Oh, right. You said that, which for the pilgrimage, which one day I would love to join. Really would. I think it'd be amazing.
You know, and everywhere, you know, now they started it with, and it would only be in Mexico City. Now it's everywhere. It's at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. It's in Rome, in France. I mean, it's all over the world. It's just incredible. And it's interesting because Univision and Telemundo, the Spanish-speaking radio television stations, always cover it the night before. And from midnight to like maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, they go all around the world, including New York, LA, everywhere. And they show these beautiful serenades with mariachi and dancers and singing, children with roses. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful celebration.
Oh, I love that. Okay, I'm going to look that up. And for our listeners, I'll put that in the show notes. So in case you want to check it out.
It's so much fun. I have this whole ritual where I put on my flannel rose pajamas. And I sit there and I watch it all night long. It's just fabulous.
I love that. I want flannel rose pajamas. Well, and I also want to say, and then I want to get back to your work, but I just feel the need to share this with listeners because I love these connections and synchronicities. It's the story of Juan Diego and the roses. There's this, I mean, this connection of Mary, no matter where she is in the world, and her connection to roses is so, it's so prevalent and so powerful. And my first guest ever on the show were Clark Strand and Perdita Fenn, who wrote a book about the rosary called The Way of the Rose. And so in their book, and I don't remember exactly, but the story of, it was a young man, again, of no real, you know, significance, I'm putting in air quotes, according to the church, who created the first rosary. And there is some story about, you know, it was devoted to the mother, and he opened his mouth and the petals, actually the rosary came out of his mouth, this rosary made of rose petals. So I just, and then of course, if you go even farther back, there's a connection between roses and goddesses that preceded Mary. So I just, I love how we see this thread through time. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so powerful. And also, you know, I don't know if, you know, of Megan Watterson, who wrote, she has these amazing oracle cards called the Divine Feminine Oracle Cards. And she just has all these different goddesses and, you know, Mary Magdalene, but she also touches on all of the different goddesses from Eastern traditions like Kali. And there's one goddess that she talks about is the goddess who's never not been broken.
Oh, yes. Ava. Oh, I can't. I know exactly who.
Akilanda, I believe.
Yes, it could be. I will put a link to it because she has come up on this show before, too. I had another guest who was really moved by her. Yes.
Yes. And I just love working with those oracle cards because, I mean, it just once again, you're inspired by these archetypes. Oh, and, you know, I always use them in my meditations to just see, you know, and I think it's once again, what I've been learning so much about my own spirituality is that it's all inside. It's in my heart. The answers are there.
Yes.
And I think it's, we've always been told something different. I always felt that when I was in, as a priest or, you know, as a minister in the Episcopal Church, I was told to share what I had learned in seminary. It was their tradition that I needed to learn so that that would be what I would share in my ministry. And I didn't resonate with a lot of it. And so for me, understanding that all of my answers, that the truth is already been, it's always been in my heart. I just never trusted it. I just never told that, you know, the answers were there, that I could go into my heart and that Christ could speak to me or whoever I was communicating with could speak to me and give me the answers I needed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me too, that's been the relationship with the feminine, you know, the not needing to turn to an external expert or an authority figure who's going to explain it to me, like how I should worship or how I should experience the divine.
Right. Or how you shouldn't, or you shouldn't, you know, mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean you're going to pray a rosary? You can't pray a rosary. It's like, yes, I can.
Of course I can. Right. Well, so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about the Guadalupe Art Program and how your participants connect with Guadalupe and what, you know, how she inspires that.
Well, you know, let me tell you, this is how it started. I was a chaplain at Central Juvenile Hall in East LA, and I would go in there and you know, these kids are depressed. I mean, they're stuck in jail, basically. And I would go in and I would try to do groups with them, and they'd look at me like, oh God, what do you want, lady? And I thought, how am I going to connect with these kids? How am I going to connect? And I had my own little Guadalupe medal where I was wearing it, and I was handing out art paper or something like that. And one little girl looked up and she said, ah, La Virgen, the Virgin. And I said, yes. And she says, oh, my grandmother taught me all about her. And I could just see the shift in her. And then the other, you know, young girls in there would say, oh yeah, La Virgen de Guadalupe, you know, like they connected. It's like, boom, it was like, I go, there it is. There is my door, you know? And I remember going home and just really meditating and praying. And as an artist, it just came to me. And I thought, you know, I thought I'm going to invite these young girls to paint themselves into the image of Our Lady Guadalupe. And so it just, you know, I really felt like that was kind of a spiritual gift that I was given, an idea. I was just inspired. And so I started doing that, and the kids just ate it up. They could really relate to that. So it was kind of connecting with their level, you know, at their level of spirituality. And they were so open and they were so excited about it. And they had already been raised by their grandmothers and their mothers to have this beautiful devotion to Mary.
I love that. I love that. And so they're painting themselves, they're painting her.
Right. They paint them. So what I would do is I would take pictures of the girls.
Okay.
And because so many of them were Mexican, I would have a collection of rebozos where the shawls, the sick shawl, shawls that women wear and carry their babies. And so they would use the different shawls and they would basically pose, and I would take pictures. And then I'd say, okay, you pick the picture that you want to paint yourself. And so they pick whatever picture and they would paint themselves as Guadalupe, in the colors and in the cloak and in the stars. And it was something, and I took it to many, many places. I took it to an orphanage in Tijuana. And I also took it to a school for in the city dump in Tijuana, where the children, a friend of mine created a school there for the children, and in the juvenile hall, detention centers for undocumented youth, and, you know, also at my church, you know, just for the children in the congregation. And it was something that, you know, it's kind of my baby. I feel like I birthed, you know, my program, and it's just so important to me, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Mm-hmm. And I hate this question of like, it's because it's very like, I don't know, it just feels very patriarchal to me. What have your results been? But you know what I mean? Like what mm-hmm. kind of transformations have you seen? Just, you know, I mean, I know you talked about the one girl that you shared the story with mm-hmm. when we were first beginning this, but you know, what happens for these girls and these women as a result of this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a group in San Diego, I remember on Fridays, and they were young girls, Latina girls from my congregation. And they would come and on Fridays and spend the whole, like from 12 to 7 with me. And they would do art, we would do dancing, we would do all kinds of wonderful things. And we also did the rosary. And I remember after a while, word got out, and mothers were bringing their daughters, their teenage daughters, to me, who they felt were rebellious. And they would say, you know, fix her. And I thought, oh, okay. So of course, you know, they were just a typical teenager clashing with their moms. And I remember one girl did this, her painting. It was just absolutely beautiful. And her mother came to pick her up, and her mother said, what is that? And she said, and I explained to her the whole process and, you know, that she was painting herself into the image of the divine. And the mother said, oh, that's not what I brought her here for. I brought her here so that you could tell her that she needs to listen to me. And the little girl came up and says, but mom, don't you see I am part of the divine? And it just kind of blew the mother away. Like she didn't even know how to answer, you know, and it's so interesting. And, you know, I think that in our tradition and in many traditions, I would say that there's a saying in Spanish about a child that, you know, I would say to children, maybe a little girl that would show up with her mother, and I would say, oh my God, aren't you just adorable? You are so, you know, I just love kids. So I would just like melt in front of these children. And the mother would say, oh, please don't say that, because in the saying in Spanish is se va a creer, she will believe. And it's almost like saying she will be conceited, but she will believe. And I would always say, and what is she going to believe? That she's made in the image and likeness of God? And what that means, you know, and the mother just wouldn't be able to say anything. But I mean, you know, it's once again, we're victims of victims of victims. So you don't want your child to be conceited. So what, you tear them down and say they're nothing or what, you know? And I think it's that whole idea of helping these children understand at a young age, which I didn't, that they are divine. It's the I am part of that, of the Christ. Mm-hmm. And empowering them with that power and helping them get out of that kind of that victim consciousness.
Yeah.
And moving from, you're not a victim. You have so many choices. You can do so many wonderful things with your life. And being able to move that way of, you know, I had one little girl who came from a family where her mother had like, you know, 7 kids. And she says, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is have kids. I said, you don't have to have kids. Who told you had to have kids? And she goes, well, it's expected. I said, but yes, I said, but the world is changing. And I said, and women are, you know, are becoming empowered, and you don't have to choose to have children if you don't want children. She looked at me like I had said something so profound. She'd never thought that she could make that choice.
Yeah, I love that. And I could see how through the process of sort of experiencing yourself as not, and to me it's different, and I don't know if you would say this too, you know, there's language from church that I grew up with about the idea of being a child of God, which is one idea, that's one mm-hmm. concept, but to be able to see yourself in the image that of the divine, that takes it to a whole different level for me. You know, it's not, and it sort of steps it out of that hierarchical relationship, and it's the indwelling presence, which I think you've spoken to already, and I can see how that would be very empowering.
Right. I had one little girl in LA. I was also serving at the cathedral in Echo Park, and I had one little girl who painted herself like in the lotus position and like meditating. It was so cute with the whole Guadalupe veil and all the colors and everything and the halo. And she named her painting Buddhalupe. And it's so cute. It's just adorable. And there were people who did not like that. They were offended. And I said, but this, you know, this is who she chooses to be. This is her interpretation. And, you know, helping, you know, oh my God, this is such an insult to Our Lady. How can it possibly be?
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I would repeat it as like, how is that an insult to, you know, paint yourself into the divine, you know? And I think that that's how we've separated ourselves from God sometimes and from the divine, that somehow we're not worthy enough.
Yeah.
Like, no, we are worthy. And I think that that's part of my ministry with the Guadalupe art program, is helping us claim that, reclaim it.
Yes. I hear that. And I feel like what I hear you saying too, when you talk about, you know, not being in the, like the victim mentality, it's not so much because I feel like there's a way that's talked about in our culture that's like, oh, get over yourself, which is awful and not supportive and doesn't acknowledge the reality of really difficult things that people face. But what I guess what I hear you saying is you are so much more than this.
Yeah,
you're so much more than this trauma.
Yeah, we're more than our trauma. We're more than, you know, all of that. And I think that once again, it's like that we are fully human and fully divine.
Yeah.
And how important that is. But I was never told that as a child. Right. You know, I was told that I need to go to confession again because, you know, I talked back to my mother and that, you know, if I didn't go to church on Sunday, I was going to hell. And so I was just like, I was terrified.
Yeah.
There's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous that says, if it weren't for the Catholics, we could have AA meetings in phone booths.
Oh my goodness. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's like, once again, about, when I would go into juvenile hall with the children and try to get their attention, I would also talk about, hypnosis and the subconscious mind and dream therapy. And oh my God, the children just love talking about their dreams, you know, and it would take them to, a higher place. I feel like the subconscious mind is kind of it's unlimited, and it's the, it like opens the road to our soul.
Mm.
And so, you know, children, we share these dreams of like, I fly in my dreams. They said, oh, that's wonderful. Keep that up, you know? And, or they'd say, well, I have this dream where this happens over and over and over again, and helping them to see what the messages are.
Yeah. Yes. Can you say a little bit more about your work as a hypnotherapist? I actually don't really know that much about that line of work.
Sure. I've been a hypnotherapist for, my gosh, maybe about 34 years now. And I specialize in trauma and PTSD. I work a lot with our veterans and first responders, and also victims of trauma and abuse. And right now I have been really focusing on past life regression, which is incredible, you know. And, you know, I know a lot of people that we come from a background of Christianity, that's a no-no. That means reincarnation. And yet, you know, this is what we've been told. And yet, if you look in the gospel, you see different parts, you know, when I think it is, you know, when Jesus asked Peter, who is it that they think I am? You know, and he says, well, they think you're Elijah. Well, I wonder how that would be, you know, it would be reincarnation. And if we go into the roots of Christianity before, you know, all of this, and even the Kabbalah and the Jewish tradition, you can find it there. I had a wonderful experience in a past life regression that had so much to do with my relationship to the church, but I would love to share that. I was in a, in my past life, all of a sudden I find myself and I'm in Europe And it's like, I'm in this plaza and there's this woman in front of me and she's being burned at the stake. And all of a sudden the plaza opens up and it's hundreds and hundreds of women that are being burned at the stake. And of course, for witchcraft in that time, right? Mm-hmm. And there's people throwing rocks at them and calling them heretics and witches and all of this. And all of a sudden I'm on a horse and I'm riding up into the forest to warn the women, you know, to run because the church is coming after us. And, you know, I'm trying to run in as fast as I can. And I'm wearing this beautiful velvet cloak, this purple cloak with gold embroidery. I can still remember seeing it in this hood. And I'm on this gorgeous, beautiful horse and I'm riding and riding and riding as fast as I can. But they're coming after me on their horses. And they, all of a sudden they're shooting these arrows and they hit me. And I'm dying. I'm falling off the horse. And it was really interesting because I could see my body as it was falling off the horse. It turned into a shadow. And as it touched the ground, it turned into ashes. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, this light comes from above and sweeps me up. And I'm face to face with the Archangel Michael. And I'm just face to face with him. And I look at him and I say, I wasn't afraid, you know. And he goes, I know you were very brave. I said, but what about the other women? And he says, it's okay, look. And I look down and that bright, bright light is just protecting the forest where the women are and the horses cannot get in, you know, cannot get in. And then that was the end of the session. But what's really interesting is where I was shot with the arrow in the back, I have a huge birthmark there.
Wow.
It's always so interesting. And you know, I always tell people, whether you believe in past life or you don't, it can be a metaphor, but it can also be so healing.
Mm. Wow. That's very powerful. Yeah. Well, I guess I have one last question for you.
Sure.
Mary, and one thing that I'm just noticing is in our conversation is, I love your energy and it seems to be infused with this sense of, I don't know, optimism, I guess. And I also say that being aware that, just through your work, you've probably seen really challenging things and heard really challenging stories. And so I wonder, well, first of all, if that's true, you know, and how yes. how you find that sense of optimism and that focus on the bigger picture and that connection to the divine, even in the face of a lot of suffering.
That's a great question, and I really feel that we all have a calling, and I found mine, and that was to be of service to those in pain and in need. I worked at LA County USC as a mental health clinician years ago, and I did all the forensic interviews for children who were sexually abused and sexual assaults in LA County. I mean, we would have like maybe 15 sexual assaults a day, domestic violence and elder abuse. So it was all of that. I mean, it was all day long. And people would always say, how can you hear these stories? You know, how can you listen to this pain? And I don't know. I think that we all have, spiritual gifts, and I'm able to hear it and be able to, to think, okay, now how do we heal? How do we heal? And I don't stay in the drama. I try to move on and just try to find the solution, try to bring some kind of hope to the survivor. And I remember it was a clinic. And so the doctor who started the clinic, she would do all of the, the forensic follow-up on the body. And so she would see all of the physical abuse. And we would have lunch together and she'd say, oh my God, I don't know how you can hear the stories. And I said, oh my God, I don't know how you can see the blood, mm-hmm. And I said, we're just given different gifts, mm-hmm. And thank God that we are. And so for me, I've always felt more that if I can't be there, I feel like that's when I feel bad, when I can't make it to juvenile hall and be with the kids that day, or I can't make it to the detention center. That's when I feel bad, because I always feel that maybe there's just a spark of hope. And I've had people say, oh, why do you go to juvenile hall? Those kids are probably going to end up in prison, or, you know, so what? You spend 5 minutes with them and make them smile. That's worth it. If I can make a child, you know, smile and be happy and explore their artwork and their talents, oh my God, I feel wonderful for them and for myself. I feel like I'm doing something that I'm called to do. And I believe we're all called to be sacred activists in this time. I feel like this is a time of a big shift. And all of this divine feminine is all a part of it. I just feel that right now we're, you know, coming into something really incredible, and it's time, you know, that we can all be a part of this change that is happening. Because, I mean, we look all around us and we see the greed and the corruption and the abuse and the violence, and we're just like, there needs to be a shift. And I think this is what, you know, Christ was talking about, in a new world of becoming a new world of love and peace, you know, kind of the age of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I just, on a personal note, I just love how you are so beautifully weaving together new age themes with Christianity. I think if I had known someone like you growing up, I would be like, church is all right.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I always, and maybe that was just, you know, my mother was very open to tarot, and my mother was a yoga teacher. And so she was always open to Eastern, you know, philosophy and meditation and all of that. So that wasn't restricted. It was more shared. And I loved all of that, all the different types of spirituality. And now for me, that has become where I resonate, is with more of a new age, if you want to call that, or once again, I'm working a lot with Pam Osley, who does incredible work as a medium, and you know, she does classes on quantum physics and teaching you how to improve your energy. And, you know, all of that just resonates with me. And I have so much hope for us all. And I think that, you know, the work that you're doing and with other women is so powerful as we come together. One of the things I want to see are more groups of women coming together like ourselves and sharing, you know, like maybe a weekly group meeting where we come on Zoom and we just share what we're doing or what we're experiencing. I joined a woman's group the other day of women who are learning to be, to develop their medium skills. And I never thought I had much of that, but I just went because they needed people to read. And so they said, well, you know, Mary, did you get anything out of that? And it was a woman that we were concentrating on. And I said, well, you know what I got? I said, I saw a woman behind her, and this woman was saying, you know, I love you. I'm always with you. And she says, but you have to move on. You have to stop this and you have to move on. And she opened her hands and she showed me a doll. And it was this like little indigenous doll with braids. And it had a white dress with yellow ribbons and green ribbons. And she showed me this doll, but she says, you need to move on. And the woman said, oh my God, you know, my mother died 15 years ago and I can't get over it. I just cannot get over it. And the doll you showed is the doll my mother gave me. It's on my bed.
Oh, wow.
And I went, whoa. You know, and I'm like, wow. You know, and the person that was giving the class, she says, we all have these gifts. We just haven't learned to develop them.
Yes. I think that's so true.
Because we've been told not to.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't play with that stuff. That's dangerous. Yes. You know?
Yes. And I also think the key is, to not compare ourselves to anybody else, right? Because they come through us in different ways. And so it's just that scarcity mentality that we, or even the hierarchy that we've been indoctrinated with, which is, well, if mine doesn't look like yours, then I'm not as gifted as you. And it has nothing to do with that. It has to do more with finding how that divine spirit moves through you, and which channels are the most open for you. That's what I think.
Right. And it's not a competition, you know. Yes. It's like, I love this, that women come in a circle and we're sharing with each other how to develop each other's gifts. It's not that someone else is the, you know, is the professional. you know, I love being the student. You know, I really feel like, you know, since I left the church now, I'm so much into these different women's groups, and I am the student, and I'm learning so much, you know, and everything, even from, you know, the story of Mary Magdalene. I remember in school being told she was a prostitute. That's what I was taught. Not that she was, you know, chosen to be the first witness to the resurrection, or that, you know, she was the first apostle, or that her relationship with Christ was so amazing that Peter was jealous.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, I think that just like when we start to really see how the church could, you know, I just think of like what, you know, Jesus must be shaking his head when they think about what they did to her.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. So true. Oh my goodness. Well, Mary, thank you so much. I love this conversation. I feel like we could just keep talking all afternoon. Oh,
me too.
But I'm so grateful to you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I hope that, you know, we can continue to come together and build a circle.
Yeah. So seeds have been planted. I love that you planted that seed of more women coming together and intentional ways to develop our gifts and support each other. So may it be so. May it happen. And so people can learn more about the Guadalupe Art Program at theguadalupeartprogram.org, correct? I'll put that in the show notes. Okay. And yes, I guess I want to thank all of you listeners, as always, for joining me here. And you know, if you have feedback for me, feel free to reach out on social media. And if you like the show, as always, I'm going to ask you to give it a good review or subscribe to it or pass along the word to somebody else who might appreciate it, or you can do all those things. And until next time, take good care of yourself, and I will speak to you again soon. Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.